Some years ago, I attended a meeting of the building committee for the congregation that I serve. At that particular meeting, we talked about a bit of repair work that needed to be done on the light fixtures that hang way up above the front doors of our meeting house. The lights are powerful enough and set up high enough that fixing them was more complicated than grabbing a footstool and a few fresh 40-watt bulbs. As always, that capable and dedicated band of volunteers were on the case, and a plan to effect the needed repair was made without incident or delay. Still, I could not help musing to myself on the obvious question that the situation posed. How many Unitarian Universalists does it take to change a light bulb? I've heard a number of punchlines to match this setup. You may feel invited to share your own with each other at coffee hour. The particular one I have in mind goes like this. It takes 20 UUs to change a light bulb, 7 to form a committee to discuss the ecological implications of compact fluorescent versus incandescent bulbs, 6 to form a committee to discuss labor practices, 6 on the aesthetics committee to discuss the exact tint and wattage, and 1 who goes ahead and does it without consulting anyone else. We Unitarian Universalists do have a penchant for forming committees. Like potluck suppers, good coffee, and the absence of hell, doing work by committee is one of the hallmarks of our spiritual communities. Out there in the larger world, there is a pernicious idea that giving any sort of task to a committee of people is at best a waste of time, and at worst, a way of ensuring that no one will be satisfied with the result. The saying goes that a camel is a horse designed by committee. This is supposed to be a hit against both committees and camels, presumably by someone who has never tried to cross a desert on horseback. Now, there are some real reasons for this bad reputation. In modern business and in government, committees are sometimes formed with the express purpose of failure, a way to appear to be addressing a problem while ensuring that no one will have the power or collective will to solve it. More often, a committee of public officials or corporate employees is not intended to fail, but it is destined in that direction, because the rules and the process that govern it completely overwhelm the purpose it was meant to serve. And so, the very idea of the committee has become associated with dysfunctional bureaucracy. The science fiction author Stanislaw Lem, who wrote in the context of communist Poland, had much to say about bureaucracies run on broken wheels. In the first chapter of his novel, The Star Diaries, the protagonist, Ijon Tishy, finds himself careening through space in a rocket ship with a broken rudder. Passing through a region known for its strange time-distorting vortices, Tishy is faced with an unusual problem. He keeps running into himself. As days and weeks bend and fold back on each other, the rocket ship becomes more and more crowded with past and future versions of the hapless pilot. Unfortunately, Tishy finds that he and his selves from Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and points beyond, and before, do not get along very well. Whenever they meet, he and his doppelgangers have an argument over who should be the one to fix the broken rudder. They squabble over the spacesuit needed to do the job, or they come to blows over the ship's dwindling supply of chocolate. Eventually, so many copies of the same person from different times have piled up in one place that the group resorts to parliamentary procedure to establish some order to things. The oldest of them, who claimed to be from next year, was elected chairman by popular acclaim. And, as Lem writes, we then appointed an elective committee, a nominating committee, and a committee for new business, and 4 of us from next month were made sergeants at arms. Finally, there seems to be some possibility of cooperation, rather than Tishy's working constantly against himself. But things do not go as planned. New wrinkles in time keep changing the size of the group, and so the bylaws must be constantly revised to set new requirements for quorum and a new slate of officers chosen to replace the ones that have disappeared. The disruption is in time grows more serious as tissues from far in the past and future, children and very old men, begin to arrive. The problem is finally solved only when two of the youngest Tishis sneak off while their grown-up versions are arguing and both climb into the only spacesuit, one boy standing on the other's shoulders. Together, they repair the rudder, and the population of the rocket goes back down to just one, Aijan Tishi, no longer lost in time. This is the common perception of what committees are all about. Wasting time with discussion while someone else shows the courage to act decisively. Friends, I am here to tell you that that perception is wrong. There are many ways to misuse and abuse the idea of the committee, as with any other scheme for organizing human beings, but the solution to the perversion of an ideal is not to abandon it, but to redeem it. Working and making decisions together is fundamental to who we are and what we are about as Unitarian Universalists. In fact, it is essential to our collective salvation. Ours is a free faith. It cannot be established in the heart or the mind by coercion, nor would it seek to be. And our meeting houses are assemblies of equals. There is no spiritual hierarchy accepted here, no division between the reprobate and the elect. We pursue democracy with reverence and treat the elements of its practice as sacraments. We have inherited this attitude in large part from the Puritan ancestors who founded many of the congregations that first became Unitarian on this continent. Puritanism in America is associated with many characteristics that we no longer admire. Humorlessness, doctrinal rigidity, abject confusion between church and state. And of course, the whole witch trial business, which still drives the annual economy of Salem, Massachusetts, which is the next town over from where I live. But the Puritans, who variously fled and were expelled from the Church of England in the 1500s and 1600s, formed their own religious communities on staunchly egalitarian ideals, at least at first. In framing the Puritan influence on the system of government in the United States, the historian A.S.P. Woodhouse has said that the congregation was the school of democracy. There, the humblest member might hear and join in the debate, might witness the discovery of the natural leader and participate in the curious process by which there emerges from the clash of many minds a vision clearer and a determination wiser than any single mind could achieve. It is here, in the basic work of struggling to live with one another in the democratic spirit, that our penchant for committees first emerges. A committee is a group of people who work together with a common purpose. Usually they are a subset of some larger grouping, a business, legislature, or in our case, a congregation. But always, and this is a critical and tragically overlooked element, always they are gatherings of equals. There may be different roles and responsibilities in the group, but in order to be effective, everyone involved must be free to contribute what they have to offer. When I was a teenage Unitarian Universalist, I served on my congregation's religious education committee. We met every month over a lit chalice and a home-baked snack. The congregation had a practice begun during the AIDS pandemic of distributing free condoms in all of its restrooms. Sometimes during our committee meetings, we would prepare little packets containing one condom, one set of instructions, and one information sheet on how to help prevent sexually transmitted infections. I remember folding the sheet of paper and packing everything into that little sealable plastic bag while we talked about curricula and teacher training. I had been a part of that congregation my whole life up to that point, but serving on that committee was what really made me feel like a member. The group depended on each of us working hard, thinking carefully, and bringing our gifts to the situation at hand. Knowing that my contribution mattered gave me confidence. It made me care more. It made me want to do more. It was good for my soul. Nearly all religions affirm that we need to gather together into groups in order to best practice our faith, whatever faith that might be. Likely you have heard before the affirmation from the Christian tradition, "Wherever three or more are gathered together in my name, there will I be also." In Judaism, a minyan, a sort of spiritual quorum, is required in order to properly perform many prayers and rites. Some number of worshipers, in most cases 10, is required in order to pray in public or to bless a wedding, for instance. There are certain levels of holiness that no one person can reach all on their own. There's actually a story from the Jewish tradition that lifts up the power of collective decision-making to an almost shocking degree. It's set a little less than 2,000 years ago. The Sanhedrin, the Council of Legal Authorities, it wouldn't be unfair to call them a committee of judges for religious matters, were debating a small point of law, and one of them, Rabbi Eliezer, found himself at odds with the others. Outvoted by his fellow sages, Eliezer declared, "If it is as I say, let this carob tree prove it." The tree immediately uprooted itself, flying through the air and out of the garden where it had been planted. But the other teachers were not impressed. "No proof can be brought from a carob tree," they replied. Rabbi Eliezer continued, "If it is as I say, let this stream of water prove it." And the stream began to flow backwards. His fellow rabbis remained adamant. No proof could be brought from a stream either. "If it is as I say, let the walls of the meeting house prove it," he declared. And the building around them began to quake. Another sage leapt up to rebuke the walls, saying, "When scholars engage in a legal dispute, what is your relevance?" The trembling stopped, but the argument continued. Finally, Rabbi Eliezer proclaimed, "If it is as I say, let it be proved from heaven." And there came a great voice from on high, crying out, "Why do you dispute with Rabbi Eliezer? All matters of the law are just as he says." But Rabbi Joshua responded, "The law is not in heaven." The responsibility of that legal ruling fell to the judges in that room, and to no one and nothing else. Not even the voice of the Holy One had standing to contradict the determination of the court. Our own tradition as Unitarian Universalists has a particular take on this. James Luther Adams, one of our great theologians of the last century, put it something like this: "Simply to be good as individuals is not enough. Goodness in a person is never fully realized. It cannot reach its greatest height until it has been turned into some collective good. We may be gentle and patient and wise and kind, but unless we have pooled those qualities with others, working together to build kind institutions and wise organizations, we will be neglecting the deep calling of our faith." Unitarian Universalism is not a religion of small ambitions. The purpose of our tradition is to save the world, not from a fiery afterlife or an angry God, but from meaninglessness and despair, and all the anguish and injustice wrought by humans treating other human beings inhumanly. James Luther Adams used to tell a story about a time during the Civil Rights era when he was a member of the Board of Trustees of the First Unitarian Church in Chicago. There was another member on that board who complained often that their minister's preaching spent too much time on racial issues. It was too political. Ought to be more realistic. Realism seemed to be a euphemism for not making trouble, trying to drum up sympathy for those people. One night at a board meeting, this man started into it again, and the rest of the group gave it right back to him. Someone challenged him to explain what the purpose of a church was. After attacks and defenses and dodging the question, trying to beg off, by the time it had gotten to be 1 a.m, as Adams puts it, the man became so fatigued that the Holy Spirit took charge. His final answer was, "The purpose of a church is to get a hold of people like me and change them." The purpose of a congregation is to get hold of people like me and you, and you, and you, and you, all you separate Zoom windows, and change us. Help us move from what we are to what we can be. And we seek to get a hold not just of the people already in here, not just to be looking always and only inside, but to reach out to people beyond our walls as well. As we change ourselves, we also change the world. And as we change the world, we change ourselves anew. In the time-twisted story of I, John Tichy, when the rocket was damaged and hurtling through space and all his older selves were so busy arguing pointlessly, it was two of the youngest who snuck off and fixed the problem on their own. But I do not take that as a condemnation of collective decision-making. It took two of them working together to fix the ship. So the moral is not the stagnating influence of public debate, but the saving power of the committee.